So particular confessions are generally written to resolve particular crises in the life of the church, and the canons of Dort are no exception. We saw a biblical example of that process in the passage just read from 1 Kings. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, troubler of Israel?" And Elijah answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." Had we continued reading down to verse 39, we would have come to the confession of faith that the Lord elicited from that crisis. Just three Hebrew words in length, which are repeated. All the people fell on their faces, and they said, "Adonai hu ha-Elohim, Adonai hu ha-Elohim." The Lord is God. The Lord, he is God. A simple but profound confession in response to a troubler of Israel arising in her midst. Fast forward then to the year 1559, to get our chronological bearings. That's the year after Elizabeth I came to the throne in England. And another troubler of Israel was born, his name also beginning with A, Jacobus Arminius, or Jacob Hermansoon, if you want the Dutch, James, son of Herman. His heresy was more subtle than that of the Baal worshippers, but it was hardly any more new, that is, than Baal worship was in the time of Ahab. We can trace Arminius's ideas back at least to the semi-Pelagians of the 5th century, who were rebuffed by Augustine in the 420s, then at the Council of Orange in the 520s, and again by Gottschalk of Saxony in the 9th century, and again by Thomas Bradwardine, proctor of this university, in the 14th century, and then implicitly at least by Luther and Calvin in the 16th. And again at the end of the 16th century, back in Elizabethan England, in the Lambeth Articles, which we've heard mention of already, 1595, and by other reformers and the Puritans who followed him. But the ideas of Arminius himself were not thoroughly and confessionally rebuffed until 1619, when the Synod of Dort fired off its famous canons. Rebuffed not in three words, as were the Baal worshippers, but in around 12,000 words in the canons. The more subtle the heresy, I suppose, the more words it takes to rebut it. The canons of Dort represent an important landmark in the history of Christian confessions, not because the error that they addressed was new, I've already indicated that it was not, but because the time had come in God's providence for the error of semi-Pelagianism to be addressed both clearly and authoritatively. And that's my basic contention in this talk, that the canons clearly, compellingly, and authoritatively, in a confessional sense, address the errors of Arminianism and, by extension, semi-Pelagianism. Now, the eagle-eared among you will have noticed already that I have made at least a couple of controversial statements so far. For a start, the canons were never formally adopted by the Church in England or the Church of England, any more than the Lambeth Articles were. So how can I say that the issue was decided authoritatively in a confessional sense? I'm also being a little controversial in aligning Arminianism and semi-Pelagianism. The Arminians want to insist that there is a clear distinction between their beliefs and semi-Pelagianism. It's hardly surprising that they want to do so. No one with any pretensions to orthodoxy wants to be associated with Pelagius. For now, I just flag those two points, and we'll come back to them in due course. We must begin by considering briefly how the canons came to be, then what the errors were that they addressed and how they answered them, before concluding with the relevance of the canons for today. First then, how did the canons of Dort come to be? Dort is a Dutch abbreviation of Dordrecht, the full name, but I'll just call it Dort. In theory, we could jump straight to what they say, but that would be negligent for any church historian. If we want to understand why the draftsman phrased what they said as they did, why they went to such lengths in saying, it's this is the truth, that is not the truth. We'd be left with a set of dry theological propositions. We would not understand why the canons were written as they are. We would also be overlooking the shenanigans which preceded the synod. It is a colourful slice of church history. It teaches us to expect that the opponents of true doctrine will be clever, subtle, and tactical. Arminius and his followers were all of those things. And errorists wanting to make incursions into our churches today will be as well. They will enter the sheep pen quietly and at night, when negligent watchmen are snoozing. Changing metaphors, they will creep into the nest like cuckoos, and by the time that you realize that they are cuckoos, you will be balancing on the edge of the nest, about to be pushed out. So let's consider first the run-up to the synod. I've mentioned that Arminius was born in 1559. He died aged 50 in 1609, and his last 6 or 7 years were his most controversial, when he was professor of theology at Leiden University in the United Provinces of the Netherlands, as they were then. He had been controversial enough as a minister in Amsterdam before moving to Leiden. He had attracted criticism for his preaching that was either hostile towards predestination or ambiguous on it. He had written against both Calvin and William Perkins before his appointment, but he avoided publishing his most controversial writings, including his work against Perkins, during his lifetime. The professor at Leiden who appointed him, Francis Gomarus, said later that if he had known about Arminius's tract against Perkins, he would never have approved the appointment. So Arminius was skilled at keeping his powder dry and staying below the radar, mixing my metaphors from a few centuries there, getting him to state his position on the issues squarely and openly was a long drawn out battle for his opponents. When the churches challenged the teaching that they were receiving from his ex-students, as they moved on from university to pulpit, Arminius refused to engage with the churches. He said he was answerable only to the university authorities, and he wasn't going to listen to them. As concerns grew, his opponents started pressing for the matter to be resolved in a national synod. Sometimes Arminius and his growing band of supporters seemed amenable to that, on condition that the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism should be amended to reflect their convictions at the same time. But if those amendments weren't to be allowed and discussed and on the table, then they were opposed to a national synod. Arminius himself did rather well in stringing things out until he was beyond the reach of any human court. But the problem did not go away at his death, quite the opposite. His teaching spread and spread through his students, gathering support, whereupon it began to assert itself increasingly aggressively. On his death, leadership passed to Johannes Utenberat. He had the support of the most powerful politician in the Republic, Johann Oldenbarneveldt, wonderful names, who was effectively the Prime Minister of the Republic. In 1610, Utenberat prepared a document called the Remonstrance, signed by 44 ministers, setting out their position on the 5 points that we will come to in due course. That's how the Arminian party came to be known as the Remonstrants, because they wrote the Remonstrance. When the Archbishop of Canterbury of the time, George Abbott, read their Remonstrance, he said they make a hodgepodge of religion, borrowing from Lutherans, Papists, Semi-Pelagians, and Pelagians. That's what Arminius' teaching looked like to contemporary Reformed eyes. The content of the Remonstrance copies a significant amount of its wording, straight from Arminius' own writings. It summarized his views on predestination. And just as Arminius had done, it called for the Belgic Confession to be amended to make it more inclusive of their views. Sounds quite modern, doesn't it? The structure of the Remonstrance, with its 5 points, then explains the structure of the canons, which will answer it. The following year, once the Remonstrance became public, the Reformed opponents produced a rebutting document called the Contra Remonstrance, and so the battle lines were drawn. attempts to resolve the matters amicably got nowhere. Over the next few years, the remonstrants, as they were known, they weren't known as Arminians at the time, grew stronger and increasingly confident that they had seen off the threat of a national synod. Pamphlet wars broke out. Town after town became divided as some sided with the remonstrants, some with the contra-remonstrants. Bitter disputes broke out among the ordinary people. A blacksmith chased the leading Arminian of the day, Simon Episcopius, down the street with a red-hot iron, intent on branding him a heretic, literally. And he was shouting, "Stop this Arminian," oh, he did call him Arminian, "stop this Arminian troubler of the church." Echoes of Elijah and Ahab there, I think. It affected commerce. Remonstrant boatmen refused to transport the goods of tradesmen known to be contra-remonstrant. In the remonstrant-leaning states, reformed pastors were systematically purged out of their churches and remonstrants appointed in their places. Congregations that resisted this remonstrantization found it necessary to gather in barns and houses and even on boats. And by 1615 or so, thousands were gathering in this way, refusing to sit under remonstrant ministry. Just notice the progression and remember that there's nothing new under the sun. The Arminians began by saying that they just wanted toleration and inclusion, just the right to exist and do their own thing. But wherever they gained power, they began suppressing their opponents and pushing them out. Cuckoos doing what cuckoos do. At last, the state authorities were persuaded that this problem was not going to go away, and the pleas of the rest of the church began to persuade them that a national synod would be the only way, not only to settle the matter, but actually to avoid civil war. James I of England had been following the events with great interest, because the Dutch were allies of the English at this time. He sent an influential letter urging the states to get on and hold a national synod. But the remonstrants made one last and rather desperate attempt to avoid trial by synod. It began in 1617 in the wealthy province called Holland, alongside the North Sea, where the Arminians had their deepest roots. That was where Olden Barneveld, the prime minister politician, persuaded the governors to pass the famous Sharp Resolution, August 1617. This allowed the towns, province by province, or in his province at least, to raise local armies, local militiamen, Waardgelders, answerable only to the provincial authorities, not the national authorities. That was quite an aggressive thing to do, and it was a step too far, and it was a miscalculation on their part. We can think of parallels between the allegiance between Utenbergaard, the theologian, and Episcopius, and Olden Barneveld, the governor. Parallels with William Laud, the archbishop, and Charles I, the king of sorts, in bringing England to the point of civil war. Well, Olden Barneveld's action with the Sharp Resolution brought him head to head with the head of the army, Prince Maurits, the Prince of Orange. Maurits was a soldier, not a theologian. He's reported as saying, "I know nothing of predestination, whether it is green or whether it is blue, but I do know that Olden Barneveld's pipe and mine will never play the same tune." Olden Barneveld and his followers refused to back down. So in July 1618, Maurits led the army to Holland. The local militias immediately surrendered. Olden Barneveld was arrested on a charge of treason, imprisoned, and later executed. So a decree was issued summoning the synod, and a date in November was set. It was to give a binding decision for the whole national church and indeed the whole republic. And to give it added weight and credence, they invited delegates from all of the reformed churches in Europe. Letters went out to the rulers of England and Scotland and France and the various principalities of what are now Germany and Switzerland, asking that they lend their wisest theologians for as long as it took. All of these states sent delegates apart from France, where Catholic King Louis banned the nominated French Huguenot delegates from attending. From England and Scotland, James sent 6 delegates altogether, a bishop, George Carleton, 2 Cambridge professors, John Davenant, Samuel Ward, the Dean of Worcester, Joseph Hall, later replaced when he became ill by Thomas Goad, and a Scot, William Balcancahal, not sure about the pronunciation, looking at Ian, chaplain to James. I'm happy to tell you that they were all Cambridge men, apart from one. I'm less happy to tell you that easily the best theologian among them was George Carleton, an Oxford man. King James instructed his delegates to practice their Latin before going so that they could explain themselves clearly, and told them to do their best to mitigate the heat on both sides. Quite good advice. Imagine how different Twitter would be if one could only post in Latin. You'll know that James himself was somewhat lukewarm in this theology. He was once described by a contemporary as the wisest fool in Christendom, but even so, we can commend him for the support that he gave to the Synod. Before we get to the Synod itself, just one lesson perhaps to note for today, and that's this familiar pattern in church history. A new idea gains traction in the academy. Then it moves down to the seminaries. Then it moves to the churches. Then comes the plea for mere toleration. We only want space to coexist alongside your old traditional ideas. And then the cuckoos start to push out of the nest, those who insist on hanging on to the old ideas. In many ways, it's the story of the advance of liberalism. How apposite still is Paul's warning to the Ephesian elders. From among your own selves will arise men speaking twisted things to draw away the disciples after them. Therefore, be alert. Opponents of true doctrine will be clever, subtle, and tactical. We mustn't adopt underhand or Machiavellian tactics in response. The weapons of the godly should be prayer and patient proclamation of the truth. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. But if we are negligent and fail to keep watch, we risk being outflanked and overrun. Therefore, as Paul says, be alert. So we get to the Synod itself. It gathered in November 1618 and concluded the following May with 150 formal sittings in between and many more committee sessions. There were around 84 delegates, of whom 2/3 were Dutch, the rest from Britain and the German and Swiss principalities. It gathered in a large hall belonging to a rifle association. Not a bad setting for focusing the mind, perhaps. But it began not with the parties taking pot shots at each other, but with prayer and preaching, each member taking a solemn oath that he would seek to be guided by Scripture alone, to the glory of God alone, with the help of Christ and his Spirit alone. After it opened, the leading representatives of the remonstrants were summoned to appear before it. It was made clear to them that they were not there as fellow delegates, but as troublers of Israel who were being invited to state and defend their teaching. It was they, after all, who had troubled the churches with their new teaching. It is they who wanted to rewrite the confessions of the church, so it was for them to prove their orthodoxy. And they resented that intensely. Leadership of the remonstrants by this time was in the hands of Simon Episcopius, who was an able advocate and had taken over Arminius's place as professor at Leiden. He demanded the right to argue his case beginning with his strongest point. As he saw it, that is the unattractiveness of an absolute decree of reprobation. His aim was to make predestination sound so offensive that the synod might be won over. But he made some tactical errors. He denied that the synod had any right to sit in judgment upon him. He cast aspersions on Prince Maurits's morality, probably with some accuracy, but it didn't win him any friends. He was tediously long-winded, probably playing for time and hoping that the political situation would change in his favour. I hope that the same thing won't be said about this talk in due course. So it went on all through December. The synod was remarkably patient with Episcopius until mid-January, but finally the president, Johannes Bogerman, told them that this could not go on. He recited their many refusals to cooperate and told them to depart. The synod went on to examine the Arminian position as set out in the 5 points of the 1610 remonstrance. They took each point in turn, though they combined the third and fourth points into one to deal with those together. The procedure was that each national group would submit a paper with its opinions on one of the points. There would be a committee session. Eventually the canons were drawn up and they were approved unanimously. In case that sounds entirely harmonious and plain sailing, I'll give you just a few little quotations which suggest a more colourful side to the proceedings. Professor Martinius from Bremen declared at one point, "Never again shall I set foot in an assembly such as this. O Dort, I would that I had never seen thee." Contrast that with the Dean of Worcester, Joseph Hall. As he was returning to England, he said, "There was no place on earth so like heaven as the Synod of Dort, where I should be more willing to dwell." And then there's a report of an incident involving Martinius, the chap who was a little less than enthusiastic, which might explain why he was. The report by one eyewitness runs, "Gomarus, as soon as Martinius had spoken, threw down his gauntlet and required the synod to grant them a duel. Martinius, after some few words, seemed a little pacified, and so the synod concluded with prayer. But immediately after prayers, Gomarus renewed his challenge and required combat with Martinius again. But they parted for the night without blows." That description of the demand for a duel comes from an observer called John Hales, who was a colourful and not entirely reliable reporter. The request for a duel was perhaps more humorously expressed than we can take from the plain words. The fact that the debates were conducted in Latin doesn't guarantee that they were conducted in an entirely scholarly and civilized manner, of course. But what is not in any doubt is that by the end of the proceedings, the canons were approved unanimously by all of the delegates, including Gomarus and Martinius. That's important. I'll come back to that point. But just a question to ponder before we move on to what they say. What are we to make of the fact that the proceedings, though peaceful at the beginning, unanimous at the end, were at times very heated in the middle? Does the heat of the debate or all of the politics that was going on at the time necessarily devalue the document? Should we distrust a creedal statement drafted by sinful men, who in the case of Dort were no doubt considerably vexed at the trouble that the Arminians had been stirring up over the previous decade? The answer, I suggest, lies in remembering that God is sovereign and well able to raise up a creed, as he has done many times in history, that is full of truth and usefulness, even if the motives of the men attending the council or synod are mixed. Creeds and confessions are not inspired writings. The sinfulness of their authors will affect their content. We must test them against Scripture and not regard them as definitive. The infallible rule is sola scriptura. But that's not a reason for setting aside the canons, however fractious at times was the national debate that preceded them. So we come on to the canons and what they say. One fundamental theme runs all through the 5 points of the Arminian remonstrance and all 5 points of the synod's response. And that is the age-old question, touched on by Peter this morning already. Does man's free will trump God's sovereignty? Does man, in other words, have the last word in his salvation? Everyone agrees that God's grace is a necessary component, a necessary ingredient. We heard yesterday how everyone says they believe in grace. But at the end of the day, does ultimate responsibility for deciding whether to accept God's saving grace or resist it lie with man? Has God given to man the casting vote, as it were, the final say? Whichever way you express that question, the answer, according to Reformed orthodoxy, is a clear no. God does not leave his sovereign plans, whether for the cosmos or for any individual within it, hanging in the eternal ether, as it were, until man deigns to make his decisions in time. If God were contingent upon man in that way, He could not be sovereign over history. He would be a god who had either been robbed of his sovereignty or had abdicated, at least with respect to human history on this planet. This issue runs through all of the 5 points of Dort. I'll quickly take you through them. They have been summarized, as most of you know, by the famous acronym TULIP. That acronym was in fact invented some years after Dort. It has its uses, but it needs to be used with caution, not least because it expresses the 5 points in the wrong order. The canons followed the remonstrants, and that order of both documents is not TULIP, but ULTIP. ULTIP, U-L-T-I-P. For now, I'm going to overlook that and take them in TULIP order, just to make it easier to follow for those who are familiar with TULIP. So let's go through them briefly, bearing in mind that all of the points are addressing from different angles the divine sovereignty, human responsibility issue. The first point of TULIP is T for total depravity or total inability. It describes the human condition after the fall. We are so thoroughly affected by sin through and through that left to ourselves, we would never choose God. Left to myself, I will choose to do what I think best. That's human nature. We will always do what we most want to do within the constraints of our nature and our situation. That doesn't mean that I will be as bad as I possibly could be. But it does mean that not in a million years will an unregenerated sinner naturally turn to God in repentance and trust in Jesus Christ as his Saviour. Remonstrants accepted the need for grace. They agreed that fallen man needs God's grace for any good work, including believing. But what they gave with one hand, they took away with the other, because they went on to deny that God's grace is ever the decisive factor. For them, grace was necessary, given the fall, but not decisive, as we will see when we get to the eye of TULIP. For the Reformed, grace must be decisive, because the seriousness of the fall means that if man has the last word in his salvation, then no man would ever be saved. That's the total inability. The second point of TULIP, then, unconditional election. This answers the question, on what basis did God in eternity choose or elect someone for salvation? The Arminian argument was that election is conditional. God in eternity peers down into the temporal world, peers into time, as it were, and looks to see who will freely choose to believe and keep on believing. Yes, with his help, with his grace, but it will be that choice of man. And then he elects those who will make make that free decision. So once again, quite happy using the language of grace, quite happy using the language of election, but filling those words with different meanings so that conditionality, contingent on man, is always the turnkey. It's often thought that Arminians deny election. They teach it, but they redefine it. They say that man freely decides his fate during his lifetime, and God binds himself to respecting man's free will decision. Election then becomes a rubber stamping exercise based on divine foreknowledge. Election for the Arminian is conditional on what man chooses. The canons say no. If you're a Christian, God chose you because he chose you, just as he loved you because he loves you, not because he foresaw any goodness or future obedience in us. Such would make Christianity a religion of salvation by works. Election must be unconditional. It is not conditional on humans wisely choosing God. Your free will did not trump God's sovereignty at the point of election in eternity. If it had, you would have rejected him. The third point of TULIP is limited atonement, as opposed to general or universal atonement. The Arminians said that Christ made atonement for every single member of the human race. The redemption price was paid for all men and every man, everywhere, in all ages. They didn't argue for universal salvation, but only for the universal facilitation of salvation. They used the analogy of Christ on the cross, purchasing enough medicine to cure the whole world. Just imagine for a moment that someone came up with a totally effective vaccine for a deadly disease that was threatening to kill everyone in the world. And some kind philanthropist purchased enough doses for every single person in the world, but actually administered it to no one. It's prescribed for you, it's offered to you, you take the medicine if you so choose. That is the Arminian model. Christ purchased atonement for everyone. And yet there's no guarantee that anyone, any single person, would accept it. Not true, said the Synod. Christ died to save his people. He died to bestow upon them alone the gift of redemption. He laid down his life for the sheep, for his sheep. When he atoned for the sins of his people, their sins in particular were really atoned for. He did not just die in the hope that some men might avail themselves of his cure. A better term is effectual atonement, except you can't spell tulip with an E. Christ's work on the cross was not merely hopeful, it was not merely facilitative, it was effectual. So once again, man's free will does not trump God's sovereignty. Not at the point of election in eternity, not when it comes to defining the efficacy of Christ's death on the cross. Fourth point, irresistible grace. The Arminians agreed that someone needs God's grace to respond to the gospel, but that grace is merely persuasive and assistive. Think again of the vaccine analogy. Christ tries to persuade you to take it, but, say the Arminians, he will not compel you, and he cannot compel you to take it. Grace is resistible, they say. You are free to refuse it. Which means that you must have the last word, and that God will respect your decision. Wrong, say the canons. That is not how conversion works. God does not merely seek to persuade, such that it remains in your power, whether to be regenerated or not. God gives you a new heart. He makes you alive, giving resurrection from the dead, to quote. He powerfully illuminates your mind as the gospel is preached. He pervades the inmost recesses of man. He makes the will good and obedient. And everyone in whom God so works is infallibly and effectually regenerated and comes to trust in Christ. So is the Arminian right? Does that mean that God compels men to believe? No, that is the Arminian straw man. They love to argue that predestination turns men into puppets, but that is not the Reformed argument. Man is not forced to believe against his will. The renewal of your mind and will and heart and the gift of faith result in you desiring what you ought to desire and doing what you ought to do. I said earlier that the essence of human nature is that we will always do what we most want to do within the constraints of our nature and situation. The 17th century expression for that is liberty of spontaneity. A regenerated person will most want to believe and persevere in believing. He will not want to resist God, not ultimately. So the word irresistible in tulip is a little unhelpful. It plays into the hands of the Arminian claim that the Reformed teach that God compels or forces a man to be saved, and that man is overpowered despite his best efforts to resist. But that's not what the canons say. The Reformed case is that once a man's heart is renewed, he doesn't want to resist. He freely chooses not to resist. The end result is that the man will infallibly be saved, but not by force or compulsion. Understanding liberty of spontaneity is the key to understanding the answer to the Arminian charge of compulsion. It's not compulsion, it's the will being changed to desire what God would have it desire. So we see that at the very point of conversion, man's free will does not trump God's sovereignty. And it's a very good thing that it doesn't. Otherwise, we would indeed resist God's grace. Lastly, then, that the P of tulip is perseverance. On this point, the remonstrants in the early days claimed to sit on the fence. In 1610, the fifth point of their remonstrance simply copied Arminius's public statements, that whether a believer may fall from their faith has not yet been resolved. In fact, Arminius had already put in writing that he believed true Christians could fall away. And that was also the view of Episcopius that he was stating publicly in 1618. He said, not only can this happen, but it happens frequently. But is it true? The synod said no. Yes, believers will struggle with temptation. They will not in this life be delivered from the body of sin. But the weakness of the flesh cannot prevail against the power of God. Having once conferred grace, God mercifully and powerfully preserves the elect, even to the end. He who began a good work in you will bring it to completion. Again, not by force or compulsion, but by moving you to will freely what he would have you will. Surely this must lead to complacency or immorality, say the Arminians. But how does Paul answer that charge in Romans 6, alluded to already? He says, "Mer genoito, may that never be. Those who are true believers will not take this truth as a license to sin. They will respond with humility, reverence, gratitude, and good works." That's the final point that the canons make. It's very arguable that this point, perseverance, is the most distinctive of the five from a Reformed perspective. All of the other points have at different times been approved by non-Reformed theologians. The doctrine of perseverance is rejected by Roman Catholics, Lutherans, and Remonstrants alike. So to summarize, the point that runs all through the five points is the denial that man's free will trumps God's sovereignty. Man and his free will do not ultimately determine whom God elects. That's because election is unconditional. Nor do they ultimately define the people for whom Christ died. That's because atonement is effectual. Nor do they ultimately define who responds to the gospel and who doesn't. That is, whether grace is resistible. Nor, if you are a true Christian today, is it ultimately you who decides whether you will still be a Christian tomorrow. It is God who ensures the perseverance of the saints. All of the five points cohere in declaring that in the end, it is God who sets his love upon a particular people, effectually calls them to himself, and is then their keeper forever. If you are a Christian today, it is because of God. The right response to that is not complacency, but gratitude. Are you a grateful Christian? There ought to be no other kind. So lastly then, the significance of the canons for today. That is the enduring significance of the canons. They express the true gospel. They express spiritual reality, not a man-flattering version of it. We need to proclaim these truths. We need to give thanks for them. We need to be spurred on in our evangelism because of them. To be reminded of them is perhaps application enough for today. But I want to go a step beyond simply saying, this is good theology, take it up and run with it. I want to go a step beyond, this is what a bunch of long-dead white men happened to teach 400 years ago. Don't worry, I'm not going to be cancelling them because they're male and white. In fact, quite the opposite. Let's come back to the couple of controversial points that I mentioned at the beginning. First, I asserted that the canons are authoritative for today. It goes without saying that they only have any authority insofar as they are scriptural. I believe they are, but it's beyond the scope of this paper to do the underlying exegesis. Assuming they do set forth sound theology, in what sense, if any, can we regard them as having confessional authority, given that they were never formally adopted by the Church of England, nor annexed to the Westminster Standards, the Savoy Declaration, the London Baptist Confession? I suppose I would have an easier task if I were on the continent or in Scotland. There they had and still have some binding authority. Debatable from this morning whether they, to what extent they do so in the English Constitution. Certainly they were immediately recognised as authoritative by the Dutch Church at the Synod itself. All Dutch ministers were required to subscribe to the canons or be dismissed, and 200 refused and were dismissed. About 40 recanted later and signed up to them later. They were also immediately adopted by the French Reformed Church, even though French Protestants had been banned from attending the synod. In these and other continental Reformed churches, the canons were approved, along with the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism, as the three forms of unity to which many Reformed churches still hold. But for Britain, my task is a little harder. The British delegates were invited at the synod to approve the canons on behalf of the Church of England, and they had to explain that they had not been sent with authority to bind the Church of England in that way, even though they had come on the King's authority, and at least two of them had leading roles in the Church. It's not that James was opposed to them or didn't approve of them. He was so pleased with the outcome of the synod and his role in it that he wrote demanding a more prominent advertisement of his personal contribution on the front page of the published version. He complained that he had not been given a title different from those of other secular princes, and so his name was inserted in the preface of the printed versions. But tragically, the Church of England never formally subscribed, though Puritans within it urged that it do so. Once Charles came to the throne in 1625 and happily endorsed the Church's disastrous drift in an Arminian direction, it was never going to happen. It's not too much of a stretch, perhaps, to say that that failure, pushed by Archbishop William Laud, led more or less directly to the civil wars. Even so, there is more to be said about the abiding authority of the canons. In the 17th century, they represented and expressed what was the international consensus among Reformed theologians. We know that because Dort was the largest and most international gathering of Protestant divines ever. And as we've seen, they came to a unanimous decision. The canons express the international consensus of the day. To quote Richard Muller, a name with which many of you will be familiar, the canons are thereby a key part of the normative body of doctrine that represents Reformed orthodoxy. The international consensus among non-Lutheran Protestants who followed the 16th century reformers is Reformed orthodoxy. When we use the terms Reformed or Reformed Orthodox, it's that international consensus to which we're referring. On that definition, there's no doubt that Reformed theology in the 17th century was aligned with Dort. Yes, it was more than just Dortian. It was also 39 articularian, if that's a word. We had Cranmerian yesterday, didn't we? So if he was allowed Cranmerian, I'm allowed articularian. It was also Lambertharian. It was aligned with the Lambeth Articles. It was also Westminsterian. It was Savoyan. Any more neologisms for today? It was more than just Dortian, is the point. But it was not less than Dortian. Aha, you may well say, that was in the 17th century. What about now? Well, let me quote Richard Muller again. He acknowledges that the meaning of Reformed developed somewhat over time, but he says that the development was limited when it comes to core doctrines. He says that the contemporary relevance of the 17th century consensus arises from the fact that it remains the basis for normative Protestant theology in the present. I'll repeat that because it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's at the heart of my answer to what is the significance of the canons for today. He says the contemporary relevance of the 17th century consensus arises from the fact that it remains the basis for normative Protestant theology in the present. In other words, even if your church has not expressly signed up to the canons, if you want to regard yourself as reformed and your theology as reformed, you cannot afford to stray far from what the canons teach. Otherwise, you place yourself outside that international consensus, not only as it stood in the 17th century, but also today. That's if Richard Muller's view is correct, and I think it is. Do you regard yourself or the church to which you belong as reformed? I hope you do. In which case, the canons are no mere optional extra. They are not merely of historical interest to those who like church history. They are not merely the musings of some dead white men from four centuries ago. The canons, even today, stand guard over the truth that was recovered at the Reformation. As another historian puts it, Robert Godfrey, the synod was not responding to a minor disagreement. It was saving the Reformation. My contention is that it continues to do so. Cast the canons aside at your peril. All of the alternatives that I can think of put man on the throne and represent some variant or other of salvation by works, not biblical Christianity. The last point of contention was my suggestion that the canons reject not only Arminianism, but also semi-Pelagianism. And by making that assertion, which would really not have been very controversial in the 17th century, you heard what Archbishop George Abbott said about the Remonstrant theology, that it was this hodgepodge of Roman and semi-Pelagian and Pelagian theology. So not a contentious statement for the 17th century. But I'm saying that not only has the true church believed and taught Dortian doctrine for hundreds of years, it has also rejected Arminian false doctrine for hundreds of years. If Arminianism is essentially semi-Pelagianism in 17th century dress, then my claim does not just extend back to the 17th century. It extends at least as far back as the 5th, when Augustine was doing battle with the semi-Pelagians of his day. But is it fair to say that Arminianism is semi-Pelagianism? Or is there clear blue water between them, as the Arminians would have us believe? It's often said by those who are arguing for clear blue water that semi-Pelagians ascribe the beginning of faith to man. In other words, man takes the first step, man takes the initiative. Whereas, they say, Arminians teach that the beginning and continuance of all good must be ascribed to the grace of God. They say, semi-Pelagians, man makes the first step. The Arminians say, we say, God makes the first step with grace, and then it's up to man to accept it or not. But is that distinction historically correct? Is it true that semi-Pelagians thought that men must make the first move towards God and only then be rewarded with grace coming the other way? The answer is no, it is not a valid distinction, at least not with any consistency. The early semi-Pelagians were monks in the monasteries in Marseille and in Hadramitum, which is now where Tunisia is. They did not speak with one voice. The leader of the Marseille monks was a man called John Cassian. He taught unequivocally the necessity of grace from the beginning to the end of the process of salvation, just as Arminius did. The exception is one paragraph in just one of John Cassian's works, known as Collatio 13, in which he allowed for the possibility that human goodwill may come first. But that's just one paragraph. It's a slim basis for arguing that Arminianism and historic semi-Pelagianism are materially or consistently different. A few semi-Pelagians may have placed the human first move towards God before grace. But likewise, so have some Arminians said that. What they all have in common is that they all believed in the need for grace, but that grace is resistible. All therefore believed that in the last analysis, it is man's response to God that ultimately differentiates the saved from the non-saved. That's the vital common ground. And it's common ground shared by semi-Pelagians, Arminians, Roman Catholics, Lutherans, and so many professing Christians today. And it's that common ground that in the end turns Christianity into a religion of works and turns God into a God small g, whose determination of history is contingent upon man. To conclude, we began by thinking of Ahab's Baal worshippers. They had constructed a God that was at the beck and call of man. The Arminian heresy is much more subtle, but at the end of the day, it too constructs a God that is at the beck and call of man. The significance of the canons of Dort for today is that they stand guard over the truths taught since the early church, truths recovered at the Reformation, that God is sovereign, and that salvation is a matter of grace, not works, from beginning to end. God will surely save all those upon whom he has set his love. So let us praise God that salvation is all of God. as it says in Romans 9, the few verses that were read before the previous talk. It is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. Amen.